What's good, everyone? Welcome back to My First Kicks. This is episode 170, and this week I bring to you my conversation with Bima Williams. Man, you do not understand how long I have been trying to get this interview. You know, I having the chance to pick Bima's brain as a fellow podcaster and also just a fellow creative is and was a special opportunity that I could not pass up. So this episode, to commemorate hitting 170 episodes of this podcast, is a special one. And I'm very excited for everyone to check this out because, you know, we touch on his path and just the way he was brought up into, you know, now currently pursuing his dreams and helping others pursue their dreams, which I find extremely fascinating. I mean, we talk about seminars where I've attended most of them minus outside of one, but I'm very, very excited for y'all to listen to this conversation. I mean, I've got to pick his brain a little bit in CopLinksCon, and I got that on video, but not to this extent. I feel like I was able to touch on questions that since that conversation at CopLinksCon that just ruminated in my brain where I can be like, all right, you know, let me come at interviewing him at this perspective. So it was very interesting. And it's also, this episode is very special because I wanted to commemorate that this podcast has reached 20,000 listens, which is a big milestone. You know, starting out this podcast, I did not even think I'd get 5 or 6 listens a week. And now I'm or have been in the ears of 20,000 individual listens. I don't know. I was going to say 20,000 people, but that's 100% wrong. So shout out to everybody who's ever listened to this. Shout out to the new listeners that are coming in to check out this Bima episode. Shout out to listeners in the future that are just binging every single episode and being like, wow, this is crazy. So if you are a new listener, please be advised that the full video of this podcast will be on YouTube. And if you just look up My First Kicks on YouTube, you'll find it instantly. Hit that subscribe button, put that thumbs up on there on this video specifically, and leave a comment. It'll help me and I will greatly appreciate it. So on to where you can find Bima. You can find him everywhere at B-I-M-M-A Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S. Sorry, I'm doing this by straight up memory. And of course, if you haven't, check out his podcast, Bars and Nuggets. Check out Claim a Stories. Try to cop a pair of the Claim a Story Sauconies. And also his upcoming collab with, their upcoming collab with Clark's. They're dropping a Wallaby, which is also very fire. And he also does seminars and offer a talk for entrepreneurs or classes for entrepreneurs, which are very interesting as well. So give it all a shot. Hit up claimastories.com. You know, try to claim a seat. And you know where to find me. I am Who Is Hasa. All social medias. Follow the podcast at My First Kicks Pod. Follow the podcast on TikTok and My First Kicks. Like I said earlier, like and subscribe on YouTube, My First Kicks on YouTube, trying to get those numbers up. And if you have a My First Kick story, would love to read it to a guest. So myfirstkickspod@gmail.com. Or if you just want to say what up, hit me up. I'm here. I will talk back to y'all. Would love to see some interactions on all the post that I post on every single social media platform. It'll be great to see some more engagement. And if you listen to my episode last week with Joe, you know I would love some more engagement. So shout out to y'all. Episode 170, 20,000 listens. And now my conversation with Bima Williams. Hey, Bima, welcome to the podcast.
Yo, what's going on? Bima here. So happy to be here. Thank you for welcoming me to your platform.
Nah, man, this is a long time coming because I am persistent as fuck. I mean, 3 years ago, I started this podcast. I'm gonna tell you a little story.
Yeah.
3 years ago, I started this podcast. 4 years, right? Three years. We'll go with three. And you were one of my, like, as I'm learning how to become a podcaster, you were one of the influences I instantly came across. You know, your story about Claim of Stories and starting Claim of Stories has always been something that I took to heart, because I was a little, you know, person with a 9-to-5 being like, yeah, I really want to, you know, talk to people about sneakers, like, on wax all the time. And when I first found you, I first found Claim of Stories, I mean, it was like, yo, you are living the future me. What I want to be. Like, I remember rolling into Complex Con and you had the van. It was a van, right?
Yeah.
That van was fire.
Storyteller.
yeah. And but the one thing that I always loved is that the one thing I'm gonna tell you is that ever since I started listening to podcasts, it's always been white faces, white voices. And it was hard to see yourself in these situations of being like, oh, I could talk to, you know, I listen to Tom Segura, I could be the next Tom Segura, you know, something like that. But you were the one person that I was like, yo, if Bima could do it, I could do it. Let's jump into this, you know? So
that's big.
Yeah,
wow, I appreciate that, man. That's a part of why I do what I do, is just, you know, like, I came up and I didn't see a lot of creatives that look like you and I. And I especially didn't see a lot of creatives that were monetizing on the other side of it. And so I was just like, yo, what can I do to be the change that I want to see, essentially, right? So that's just the path I've been on. And I'm happy to hear that connected and resonated with you.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's connected with a lot of people, because you're out there. I feel like I went from not seeing, like, you had to find you, to now you're like, yo, I'm here. Like, let's get it. I do think, because one of my favorite interviews that you've ever done, and I think I took a lot from, where it gave me, like, that, like, motivation to just keep going, was that Tyler interview.
Man.
That Tyler interview in France, Paris?
Yeah. It was in Paris, France, man. That was a great time.
And it's like, because me and Tyler are around the same age. I feel like he's like 1 year older than me or younger than me, one of those. And he talks about, like, do it. Like, it was like a lot of it just like, why? What's stopping you? Just do it, you know? And you are the antithesis of that. And so,
yeah, you got, I mean, Tyler's very, you know, I was talking about this last night. I have an accelerator that I facilitate with other creatives. And what Tyler speaks a lot about is not editing yourself out of ideas before you try them. Like, a lot of us will get in our heads and we'll edit these ideas before we even put them into the world and know if they can succeed or not. And I think that's such an important thing that I've been practicing myself, is just like, try it. Like, there's nothing wrong with trying things, experimenting, failing, trying something else.
Yeah. And I mean, before we jump into that, though, I'm gonna hit you with the question that I ask everybody each week, and that's, what's your first kicks? What's that first pair of sneakers that you absolutely needed to have? But the funny thing is, I asked you this at ComplexCon, so I'm gonna just cut into this video where I ask you this question now. What's your first kicks? What's your first pair of sneakers that you absolutely needed to have?
In life. It was Jordan 9s. I remember it was Jordan 9s because my cousin, Trenisha, she played basketball and she was a couple years older than me. And to me, she was the dopest, swagged out, whatever, dripped out person, whatever word you want to put on it. That was Niecy to me. And I was like, it was Christmas time. I was a kid. I was like in third grade. And I was like, Mom, I want these. I didn't know nothing about sneakers, none of that. I just wanted to be like my cousin. And that was when I realized, like, adult sneakers are different than kids' sneakers.
Yeah.
Because hers had the red button with the detail.
art on the back, and mine was just a red button.
That's too funny. That difference, yo. But I mean, kid sneakers during that time were undefeated. Like, you were just getting, you were like, yo, I was looking fine.
I was like, you know. And then they had completely different details. Yeah. Completely different materials. Now the kids' shoes are like almost 1-to-1.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but they was cutting corners on on my shoes.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a great answer, man. our conversation at ComplexCon, you know, you gave me a lot of insight into like your process in a short time, and I very gracious for you giving me that time, especially after you interviewed IDK. And you're like, I would still talk to you. I'm like, that's crazy. You just
I'm about it. Like, if I tell you that's the way I'm gonna show up and help. Like, I'm gonna take the time to do that, because why else are we there? Why else are we at ComplexCon? Why else are we in that close proximity to each other? Like, we're community, right? Like, there, to me, there's no hierarchy. Like, we're community. So,
Speaking of community, I'm very curious about like how you grew up. I have your shoes right there. So I know you grew up in NOLA. So what was growing up in NOLA like?
Yeah, so I actually grew up just outside. I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I grew up going to a lot of college football games, whether it was SU, Southern University, shout out to the Jaguars, or going to LSU, where I ended up going to college, support my Tigers, right? And so I just grew up in a community that was really much about two things. It was about college football, and then it was also about oil and gas, right? And so when I really kind of got like my creative light bulb, or just was able to really tap into my creative side, was when we started, my mom and we would start going to New Orleans, and like I saw a whole nother side of Louisiana, and I saw a whole nother side of the world, because it was completely different than the rest of Louisiana. And it was so inspiring and eye-opening. And then and I felt like, I kind of felt a bit like seen, and I felt like I was seeing things of like people that look like me doing creative things, whether it be like cats having art shops, or cats having consignment shops, or putting on events and these parades, and like so many different things were happening in New Orleans. And when I would go back to Baton Rouge, I loved it, but that just wasn't there. That's just not what the scene is. And so I would grow up kind of in that duality of like, trying to appease my parents and going to school and all that stuff. But I wanted to be a creative, but that wasn't a terminology we used, back then. Nobody even knew what that meant. So I would grow up, like a normal kid. I grow up in, I wasn't a normal kid. I was in the sneakers very early.
I was just going to ask, you talk about your creative, you wanted to be a creative. Like, where did you show your creative out? What was your creative outputs?
Yeah. So for me, the sneakers was that first thing that just really like tapped in with me. And it was about the storytelling. Like, I remember like just so many different stories. I remember like 05 when SB was just like hitting, and everything from Boca Juniors to Diamond Dunks, Ooh. Dinosaur Juniors. Goodness, there's so many.
That pink box era was crazy.
The pink box era, and you had to actually hunt for things, and you actually had to like figure out what shops had what. I remember I would leave work at lunch, and like it would be like an hour and a half commute there and back to go get some sneakers. Like, damn near about to get fired trying to go get some sneakers, bro.
What was your first job?
My first job, I was 14. I was working at a water park called Blue Bayou. If you ever heard Wayne rap about Blue Bayou, I'm forgetting the line, but Blue Bayou is just like this water park that everybody went to in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And I was 14, and I was like working in a chicken shack, and this is going to hurt a lot of feelings, but I went to work every day in Space Jam 11s. I destroyed those shoes.
You were fresh though. You were fresh. You was in there fresh.
I destroyed those shoes. I was working at a chicken shack and oil and grease. I was like, what is wrong with me? I would never do that now. But you know, I was a kid. I didn't know no better. But
I thought you was gonna be like, I work at a chicken shack, and let me tell you, it's gonna hurt a lot of people. That chicken ain't real. And like,
that wasn't the case. But yeah, man. And then when I got into school, I was just working at some data entry gig, and mm-hmm. so I knew, you know, sneakers was still in me. So I was just like, I'm still gonna collect and do my thing. But I had a small subset of friends that were part of that sneaker mm-hmm. streetwear community, and you know, a lot of athletes on campus, from Tyrus Thomas to Big Baby, would always they'd be like, yo, what you got on your feet, where you get those from, you know? So we were the kids that was like really early on a lot of that stuff mm-hmm. in Louisiana.
I mean that's wild. It's like, were you making lines back then too, or did a lot of your friends come from lines too?
Yeah. So I was, you know, I was camping out. Like, I'm camping out overnight, mm-hmm. you know, picnic seat, Red Bull, sunflower seeds, you know, water money in your pocket. You got to have homies because mm-hmm. it gets crazy out there. If you solo dolo, don't do that. But I remember there was a crazy launch when Space Jams came back out, when they retroed mm-hmm. them again. What was this, like 2008? And yeah. Me and a couple of the homies went and waited in line for the release at the mall. And I remember going to the mall. I had like a G in my pocket, and there were like hundreds of people in this line. I got there early. I got there the night before. So mm-hmm. we were in the front of the line, and it was so packed that we almost were like smashed against like the opening door or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just remember there was a worker that didn't know what the hell was going on. And they opened that door and it was fucking mayhem. All I know was we was just sprinting up escalators to the Champs is where we went.
Oh, it wasn't like you weren't able to stay inside the mall. You had to stay outside the mall.
Outside the mall. They did not let you in the mall.
Woo.
That was no, because no one's in the mall. They don't have a lot of security. Nothing's open. They don't want random people walking through the mall yet. Mm-hmm. So I remember sprinting up the escalator. I think somebody got fell. I don't know what happened to them. I feel bad. And I just remember giving some money to the cat before me and giving some money to the cat behind me. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, yo, whatever happens, just like get me these sizes. And I think I left the mall. I left the mall with like 8 to 10 pairs of Space Jams that day. And I had to walk out one of the side doors because I was one of the first. And mm-hmm. like, I remember we walked out and my homie was picking us up and they had cats looking at me and I was like, yo, we got to go.
I was getting them for my homies.
It was me and my homies. So I was making sure they had their pairs too. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's all, you take care of the family.
People were looking at you like you were lunch meat. They were
they was coming because that's in, you know, that's the era where Jordan 11 Space Jams, like mm-hmm. you know, it's that's a lot of money on the line.
Oh yeah. I think is it during that time they filmed Just for Kicks, or no they filmed Sneakerheads, I think, right?
Yeah,
around that. And then they talked about that one kid dying for a pair of 11s or something like that at the end, and it's super sad. But
super sad
that era of, like, you know, it was pandemonium at every single Jordan, like high level Jordan launch. Was not a fun time. I'm not like, it's just like worrying about stuff behind your back and stuff. You'd be like, yo, can I trust this person? It's tough. Like, that was tough. That was a tough time.
Yeah, it's not that's the scary stuff, man. We gotta be careful about that stuff. Like, I don't want anyone losing their life over no sneakers.
Nah, yeah. When you were buying so many, I mean, it sounds like you were racking up.
Oh, I was heavy.
Prior lunch.
I was like, all my money. That's where all my money went. My mom was like, bro, what are you doing?
I was just gonna ask, like, what was the reception from your parents when you're like, just have a stack of sneakers? Like, what was that like?
My mom just, you know, she, you know, I love my mom. She worked at a chemical plant mm-hmm. and she just wanted me to go to job, you know, go to school, get a good job. You know what I mean? And she for the life of her never understood the sneaker thing until now. Right. Like, and I mean now, like for past 10 years now, but during that time,
right now,
you know, not right now, but like, you know, like during this time,
yeah.
It's like, you know, at that point she couldn't, there wasn't a route for me to go work in the industry. There wasn't a route for me to monetize a podcast. There wasn't a route for me to like then become, you know, my own personal brand within the industry and figure out mm-hmm. how to do any of these things I'm doing now. And so, of course, you know, you're a parent, she's looking at me crazy because she's like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you like, this ain't like, you know, she's like, we don't, and she didn't, you know, she didn't come from an era where like you got to get paid for the things you were actually passionate about. That wasn't like, that was a thing. That was like that's a hobby to her, mm-hmm. you know? So I understand exactly where she was coming from, but now I get to say, now you see where that money went.
all them pairs. Like, yeah, my mom, I mean, I'm a first generation immigrant. So like my mom's perception was like, are you making a store? Like every single pair that came in, are you like, you got like a store? Like, I'm like, no. This is all for the toe. Like,
it's crazy. You can't, there's no explaining this to parents. It doesn't make sense.
Especially it like died. The older parents where they're just like, oh, we work to give you a better life. And you're like, sneakers.
That's what you want to do. That's what you want to do. Until you show them how you can like really make a living off of it, they don't believe you. Even then, they barely believe you.
No, yeah. Were you aspiring to work in sneakers in high school, or is it just like it kind of just like a turn of events where you saw a lane open up?
Yeah, no, this was never opportunistic for me. This was always a part of my DNA. So, you know, me and my friends had a couple of different ideas. Like we had a streetwear brand when I was going into college. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was a designer and she had come up with this kind of idea called the Dope Game. And she was really, really, she still is to this day, really talented when it comes to graphic design. And I just had a bit more acumen around like different marketing stuff and ideas and stuff like that. So I came in to help with those things. And so that was like one of the first things. And like we, like I said, we were the kids that were raised on Complex Print magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got the introduction into like the Flight Club existing in New York. Our senior year, our senior trip, we went to New York and we were the only ones that ended up going to Flight Club because, you know, some of these other kids wanted to go, you know, some of this other stuff. We're like, nah, we trying to go to a Flight Club. We trying to go see Union. Like this is, we about the sneaker life. Mm-hmm. And which
Flight Club was this? Sorry.
It was,
Was it the one on Green Street, the smaller one?
It was the Green Street one.
Yeah.
It was the Green Street one.
So you actually got to talk to Chris because Chris, yeah.
If he was there, I don't know. I honestly don't remember who mm-hmm. At the time, but it just was changing. It changed so much. And I was like, yo, it'd be dope if we had like our own, like, you know, store or if we had something like that. But we just didn't know. We didn't have the acumen to do any of those things. But we tried, right? And so we ended up doing that for a minute. And then as I got older, you know, I kind of, that dream kind of faded because I was just like, yo, I don't know, this ain't really going nowhere. And mm-hmm. We couldn't figure out how to scale and actually make money from this thing. And so I ended up just focusing and going do this data entry job. And I hated it.
Yeah.
Because I still dress like me, but I was going to work with folks that, you know, were 10 years older and they were mm-hmm. super nice people, but they had kids and they were wearing like pleated khakis and hard bottoms and polos. And actually, don't get me wrong, I still get a polo off today, but you know what I mean? It was just mm-hmm. different. And so it wasn't until I decided to do this passion project where mm-hmm. I was documenting the running community in Louisiana. I grew up a runner. I still run to this day. That's always been a duality for me, is like I run, but I love sneakers mm-hmm. From a lifestyle standpoint. And that's what actually got me into the sneaker industry, was because I got recruited off the internet. You know what I'm saying? So, it wasn't opportunistic. It was in some ways in spite of myself. But then also I've just been genuinely interested in it, you know, beyond just the the hype of it.
No, yeah. It's funny because I wanted to be like, that sounds just kismet, to be honest. Because it just sounds like once you get not backed into a corner, but I understand what you're saying. Like once you're doing a job or doing something every day that just is not there, doesn't satiate that creative
side. It's miserable.
For you, it's terrible.
No, say it plainly. It was miserable.
It was miserable. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It wasn't nothing about satiating. It was miserable. I'm doing stuff that this is the most boring work a human could do that like now AI, we would never do this work. And you know, I was literally there just for a paycheck, fam. Mm-hmm. And so I just, for me, and I know for some people, and we got to get paid. So I don't hate on anybody trying to get their money. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was like, I can't do this. I have to figure out how to do something that I'm actually interested in, that I can excel at, that is creative. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know how it was going to materialize. And that's the thing I want to share right now is like, a lot of times we don't know. Anybody that tell you they know, they lying. Nobody knows. Nobody knows anything. You can't predict the future. And sometimes you just got to lean in on faith. You got to trust it. You got to do it. You got to lean into your own intuition. And sometimes it'll work out. It don't work out all the time, but sometimes it works out. And that's where I was at. I was like, something got shaped.
That's because I've been there several times. Actually, I might be there right now. But how do you? Because I've always been a big proponent of like setting myself up for success, mm-hmm. right? And because I always look at it like you're just jumping into the deep end. There's no, you don't know what's at the bottom of this lake. So
you don't want to know.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. So how did you get into the mindset of like, nah, I'ma just, jump in right now?
I was inspired by a homie of mine, actually. So my best friend lives in New Orleans, Jared Cohen, and he has this wealth management firm. So we connected just because we homies and we went to school together and all that stuff. But our interests are slightly different. So his interests, like we both want to get money, but he wanted to get money from the financial side. And I wanted to get money from the creative side. But both of us want to impact, Black and brown community from that perspective. So at the time he had moved to Houston and he was doing his thing, as far as I was concerned, he was like in his pocket, he knew his path and he was going, he'd come back to visit and he'd tell me what he had going on. And I was like, damn, what the hell am I doing? I'm sitting here every day complaining. I ain't doing nothing that's, related to what I'm interested in. And here's my homie bringing it to life, doing his thing. Mm-hmm. And so I just started to try to start reading some books. I remember reading Jim Collins' Good to Great. That was helpful for my mindset. I had to do a lot of work on my mindset because my mindset was not in a strong place. I'd say I had a weak, fixed mindset, and I had to figure out how to get a growth mindset. Didn't even know what that meant at the time. Mm-hmm. Starting to read some of these books where it started to unlock a little bit in my mind of what was possible. So a part of it was that. The other part was like my dad at the time had gotten cancer and it ended up being terminal cancer.
Wow.
And I just started to realize like, fam, like you don't want to sit around and let your life just like your life could go like that. And you're going to sit around every day and just complain that can't be it. And so it was a combination of those things that started to shift my mindset where I was like, nah, it's about action now. I'm not going to let another day go by where I don't try to do something to try to make it better. I don't know where I'm going, but in my mind, I position it as like, it was scarier to me to be gone tomorrow and not having tried to do something right. That was aligned with what I was interested in. And that was one of the biggest unlocks for me. That happened in 2010, 2011. When I made that was the shift. And that's the way I've operated since. Like, cause I'm like, ain't no way knowing what I know now that I can't make a lot of these things possible.
Nah, man, that's amazing. I feel like a lot of people need to hear that in terms of just like jumpstart. Somebody needs to record, like clip this, just play it every morning.
the biggest thing if I can get across to any creative is the mindset. Like,
for sure.
It's, everything else is hard. Everything mm-hmm. else is just baseline hard. The hardest thing is here, because we will talk ourselves out of so many things before we even try them just because of our mindset. Mm-hmm. We'll get in our head in this negative self-talk. I'm not good enough, or I don't know enough, or nobody cares, or people don't like this and that. And the only thing that is true is what we tell ourselves. Perception mm-hmm. is our own reality. If I believe I'm not capable of those things, they won't happen. The moment I decided I was capable of something more than where I was, then other opportunities started to show up. I started to see things differently that mm-hmm. I didn't see before.
No, yeah, that's like super eye-opening, because I think the hardest part is I feel like the way the world is built is always to teach you how to be negative about, like, oh, you can't do this, you can't do this. And it's the people that are that, like, that push past that are the people that are always pushing forwards towards success. Like, I feel like, and I've always said that, like, even in high school or like in school settings, it's like, it's how much you know, how much these books tell you, how much you're able to memorize. But like the extra part of school is the people you meet, the network you build around it, because you can just pass all the tests, not talk to a single soul, and you're just going to end up being the same place you graduated at, you know, like you're just going to be by yourself with a degree. Like,
all those degrees, you remind me of the college dropout skit. Yeah. but no, like, it's a combination of those things, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. I say in two part. One is delusion. You gotta be delusional, because what you're trying to do, I'm sorry, it's not to your friend group, that shit ain't possible. Mm-hmm. You know, coming out of Louisiana, going work at Saucony, going work on Yeezy, going work at Nike Entertainment on collaborations, that shit is not possible. Mm-hmm. Where we're from, it's not. And there's so many things working against you. And so the imaginary willpower that you have to conjure up to navigate the hurdles that you're going to navigate, mm-hmm. like, it's a real thing. And then on top of that, where I'm an introvert. And at that stage of being an introvert, I did not like introducing myself to people. I did not like talking to random people. So I did not have the network. So I had to also learn those things and figure out how to get to those places where I could, like, put myself out there without feeling awkward or mm-hmm. feeling judged and all those things. But those are two of the components that you absolutely have to figure out how to dial in.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how did you find out, or like, how did you navigate high school while being an introvert?
I had extroverted friends.
But how did you get to that point where you were like, all right, like, did they just bring you in? Was it always like them bringing you in?
Okay. Extroverts always find introverted friends. Here's mm-hmm. the reason why. Extroverts like to talk. Two extroverts talking, nobody hears anything. They get annoyed with each other. You need an introvert. you need a me. Yeah.
Somebody's there just being like, mm-hmm,
uh-huh. Mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. need someone that just gonna listen. And so you know, funny enough, in high school that kind of is what happened. But I also was in sports. I was a runner, so I was on a team. So I already had a natural kind of baked in network of folks and friends at that point. But you know, I didn't really hone the ability to try to grow from an extrovert standpoint till I was well out of college. So mm-hmm. it wasn't until I was like 24 where I was like, okay, I need to like start putting myself out there. I need to try to start figuring out how to speak to people that I don't know, mm-hmm. grow my network, get some mentors and some advisors. And, you know, one of the ways that I did that was, you got to put yourself in uncomfortable situations. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the biggest hurdles that I encountered as a creative, because I was like, man, I don't want nobody to reject me. I don't want to try to, you know, somebody snub me like that. Just, to me, that was the biggest fear. Mm-hmm. And I remember, it's so funny because it has nothing to do with sneakers, but I was going to this running club once a week on Tuesdays. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, I'm gonna just try to meet some people. And these folks welcomed me, and I started to make some friends, and I was like, okay, this is bet. And then from there I started doing my blog, and started just putting myself in a situation where I was like the interviewing. So I was interviewing people back then, but not like in this capacity. It was more mm-hmm. so just written. And so it put me in a space where I started to have to get comfortable engaging people. Mm-hmm. And that is literally how I started to cultivate my comfort level of meeting people.
that's wild. I mean, I could tell you, I don't know if I've told this story on here before, but there was a moment. So I thought I was always good with people, but I realized I'm not an introvert or an extrovert. Like, I'm cool going out a lot and introducing myself to people, but I do have a social battery. I feel like extroverts are just like, we out every night, and I'll be looking at people and be like, nah, I'm staying home. But there's this moment. So one of my favorite rappers is POS, and from Minnesota. And so I saw him live, but before that I was kind of friends with him on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so I go see him perform, and funny enough, Lizzo opened for him.
Wow.
And so I'm talking to Lizzo, and I had like a weird interaction with Lizzo, and I'm like, why is this like being weird, whatever? Because I've spoken to artists before, but I've always kept it like about the music. Yeah. And now I'm meeting somebody who I like their music, but we've talked about other things, so we have a rapport. And when I meet him, it was just awkward. It was like the worst. I was like, what is going on, right? And I realized it's me, right? It was just me. The way I was like approaching it, it wasn't like a, yo, it's cool. Let's, you know, we already have a rapport. Like, we friends. Like, it was like, I felt this like weight of like, oh, his music changed my life. I got to make an impact. And I think I put so much pressure on my head that on my mind about it, that it caused me to be like this like shut down version of myself.
Yeah.
And so as I kept like, after night went on, whatever, I was just like, this got to change. And I just left. And I was just like, I spent like a month just being like, okay, next time I meet, like, I was just like, let me, that was like the most awkwardest situation I've ever been in. And like, it changed my way of how do I approach people. And from then now, I mean, podcasts, and as you can see, I might have been the most approachable person you've met at Complex Con.
Yeah, you can get in your own head with a lot of this stuff. And also, it's just like when you're meeting people that you admire, that can also be a challenge too. But I think we also have to realize that these folks are also humans, and they have people inundating them all the time. Mm-hmm. And so we can't really take these things personal. If that interaction doesn't go how we have created how it should happen in our mm-hmm. head, right? Like, it's about being present in that moment, and you know, allowing it to be what it's going to be.
No, yeah. I think the hardest part right now is like, I don't want to, every time I introduce myself, tell everybody about my podcast. But then at the same time, I'm like, I got to tell everybody about my podcast.
You got to tell them. It's part of what you do.
Do you do that? Like, are you especially when you were first early starting off, like when you took the leap and you're like, all right, now, well, this is the other leap, you know, I'm doing my thing,
yeah,
you know, leap. But like, when you got to that point, were you also like forward about like, these are my intentions, these are who I want to talk to? Like, how much of that did you put in the ether and like in conversations as conversations happened?
Every conversation. Mm-hmm. You don't have the luxury of not putting it in every conversation with your livelihood, right? You can't be cute about it. Like, this is how you get paid. But also, the thing that I try to remind people is that I don't do podcasting just for myself. Mm-hmm. I do podcasting because I'm actually trying to change the lives of the people that are listening to it, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I'm not doing my job of promoting it, talking about it, trying to grow it, trying to get into these different places, trying to be disruptive, right? I'm letting a lot of people down who are trying to get this information, right? And I'll be that upfront with the people that I would have on the show, right? So when we were recording Melody Ehsani, and we were recording James Whitner, we were recording Jason Maiden, you know, mm-hmm. some of these folks, Woody, you know, we would be a Laylee May. We would be very upfront and be like, yeah, this is a podcast, but this is what this podcast is to do. This is what our listeners are. This is where they come from. They come from just backgrounds just like you, right? Like we came up from nothing. I was like, you have an opportunity to impart some wisdom to actually help them on their journey, right? And I think especially Black and Brown folks, it touches folks on a different level when you say it that way. And so I very early on realized like no one's ever gonna root for me as hard as I'm gonna root for me.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not rooting for me, how in the world is anyone else gonna do it? You know what I'm saying? Like you can't expect someone else to be the champion of what you do if you're not even a champion of what you do, right? You gotta be proud as hell about it. You gotta, you know, I always give DJ Khaled, you know, some shit. But here's the thing. Don't nobody promote DJ Khaled better than DJ Khaled.
Yeah.
When he walking around with signs saying, you know, Drake on my next album, or, you know, like no one better. No mm-hmm. one's better at the self-promotion than him. And that's the, and some folks see it as corny, but I guess what? DJ Khaled ain't worried about how he getting paid.
He definitely not.
You know what I'm saying? And that's when I talk about creatives, like we got to get out of our heads of like, oh, you know, it's salesy or it's corny, or it's like, fam, it's commerce. And if you want to get paid, you got to talk about what you do, and you mm-hmm. got to figure out how to get comfortable with it. Cause it, otherwise the opposite is you not paid.
Man, I mean, that's like, it's so true. I mean, I will be the first person to tell you, I think DJ Khaled's corny, but he does get his, like you will get everything that he's selling in one shot. Like you go be like, yo, all right, he's putting out an album now, or like, oh, he's putting out Jordan 5s. Like, you know, it's coming out. So it's very true. I don't know about integrity. Like, it's like, do you lose integrity by doing that all the time? Or is it just because it's about you? Is that your identity now of like, oh, like my whole thing is like, I'll be playing straight up with you. I don't want to be called a grifter like at any point in my life ever.
Here's the thing. People going to say what they want to say anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control what they're going to say. They're going to say what they want to say anyway. What I say is when it comes to that, you got to get more creative about how you go about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So subtle things to promote yourself, right? If you have a streetwear brand or you got a podcast, make a podcast t-shirt, put your homies in it, tell them walk mm-hmm. around complex. You get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Make a guerrilla marketing sign. Put that thing out there, right? Put some booklets over at your favorite sneaker shop, right? Everything doesn't have to come from your mouth, right? Enlist some other folks to talk about it by giving them something, they might repost it. You know what I'm saying? Like, get a little more clever with how you go about the promotional side, so it's not only coming from you.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll lighten some of that load. You know, the reason why artists do collaborations on albums is not because they actually always want to do a collaboration song, but because they know people are going to talk about it as well. It has a word of mouth aspect to it. And so when you're working on your podcast, right? Like a part of interviewing and having someone on is like the opportunity for them to also then talk about being on the show and that conversation and help sharing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, you know, things like, I don't know, a seating kit, a mug or something like that, mm-hmm. sending people, just whatever you could do to try to get creative about spreading the word and the message about what you're doing. So marketing promotions is always going to be an aspect when commerce is involved as a creative. If you are an artist, that's different. If you want to be an artist that exhibits and things like that, that's different. That's different. You go through the gallery route, all that stuff. You still got to figure out how to sell it though.
Yeah. True. Where did you learn a lot of this stuff? Because I feel like, you know, you've worked in such big companies and, you know, I feel like you've been around such big activations and cool stuff, and you got to release 2 sneakers, you know. I still need the purple pair. But you've done a lot of these things, but like what are like some pivotal stories from each moment of your life where you're like, I'm gonna take this in and mm-hmm. now I'm gonna craft this into a bigger thing, and like lessons learned.
Yeah, so when I was coming into Saucony, like I had a strong understanding of social media. So this was 2000, leading up to 2013. So 2012 was a big year, and I had my own blog, and I had a mentor, and she was getting paid to do social media at the tourism board in Baton Rouge, and so she gave me a lot of game on like the strategy behind social media. And then at the same time, I also was just seeing things and trying different things. I'm a sampler. If I see it, I'll try it, spin it, you know, put it into play and see what I can learn from it. And then when I got into Saucony, this is the first time where I got around other marketers. And I'm not a traditional marketer. I don't have a marketing and advertising degree. So everything that I have is purely from application. It's purely from experience, trial and error. And when I got in, what I realized was that I was more savvy than a lot of people when it came to social. So I used that as a strength, but I started to learn from them the other stuff. So the stuff when it came down to seeding, when it came down to planning out the length of a campaign, when it came to creating digital web pages and email strategy. And so one of these things was like when we were working on collaborations, the performance team would work with this agency, and they would give them a deck. And in the deck, it would say, you know, what we're promoting this new running shoe. And this is like the objective behind what we're promoting. This is the audience we're trying to get in front of. And this is the idea for what the images and the campaign is going to look like. And that was my first time ever seeing someone premeditate what a campaign was going to look like. I was so used to doing it in the moment.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, this is interesting. Bet. And then in that same building was another company called Sperry. And Sperry had this homie named Pervy, and she was doing some stuff with influencers, right? And so I'm like, this is interesting. And they like seeing them sneakers and product and stuff like that. And so I don't have anyone that's telling me what I can't do. And so again, I'm a sponge. I'm not trying to perfect. I'm just trying to aggregate things and bring them together.
Yeah.
So I had this opportunity to pull together this program called Originators Only. And this was 2015, and this was at the time where Saucony is a smaller brand. We couldn't compete with what Puma and Nike and Adidas were doing. They were going the big celebrity personality creative route. So Kanye, Rihanna, Drake were the big three in that regard at the time. And I knew it was going to change the whole landscape of what was happening in the marketplace, because up until that point, it was really what was really selling in our marketplace was concepts and New Balance. New Balance was moving heavy. Diadora was moving heavy. And Saucony, we were doing really, really well. But I was like, yo, we got to get creative because we don't have that type of budget. And so I was like, Pat, I'm going to pull all of these things that I've been absorbing and learning, and I'm going to make this program. And so the program was going to combine social media strategy, influencer marketing, affiliate marketing, and product creation. So what that meant was, from a social media standpoint, we were going to roll out a whole digital campaign telling stories around these different influencers that just really rock with Saucony. On top of that, we were going to tap influencers that were on YouTube, because no one was working directly with folks that were viewing on YouTube. In fact, folks were like, oh, these cats are corny. Like they, you know, they work in their mom's basement, whatever, whatever. Super disrespectful to creators at the time. Whereas now it's completely flipped, right?
Yeah.
Now it's completely different.
Everybody's doing it now.
and bringing them in house.
Yeah.
Bet. This all started at Saucony. Nobody could take credit for this. They could just go look at the receipts. So then affiliate marketing, because I, at the time, you couldn't really say how you could monetize social media. There was no real direct way to show how you could monetize working with an influencer. So I said, bet. The influencers taught me this. They said, we get paid from y'all from our reviews through affiliate links. I said, bet. And then the fourth thing, I said, we're going to go one further. Y'all going to design your own sneakers and we're going to sell them on Saucony.com. So I put together this whole campaign, and we shot this video. I brought all of them to Saucony 10 of them in a single weekend. It was like Homer Simpson and Bullet 103 and Tony D2 Wild, T Blake. It was a lineup of cats. And we had all of this engagement because I told them they could film the whole thing. And they came and filmed in the office, and I got them on the treadmill, and then I gave them materials to create their sneakers. And so it was the first time you started to have kind of this 360 approach when it came to that. And we did an activation on Newbury Street at Johnny Cupcakes. We took over the whole store and made it a Saucony store.
Wow.
This is all stuff I did for the first time.
That's wild, bro. This is
all stuff I did for the first time experimenting. Now I had guidance. Like I had some folks that I had to lean in. So I had like teammates and colleagues that I was like, this is my vision for it. I don't know how to execute it. You know how to do a store takeover. So I need you to come and actually make it real. You know what I'm saying? But I was able to quarterback and lead that campaign. And the results were, you know, being featured on different platforms like Hypebeast, selling out these shoes in 5 minutes. And then all of the engagement and views that we saw then on social. And then down the line, we ended up launching a Saucony exclusive program that was successful because we had done that. And the biggest thing was when other brands started doing it.
Man, that is, first of all, yes, I remember all of that. And it's wild because one thing I was curious about it, like when that first happened was like, how much of this is a result of like the sneaker community on the forums? Because like during that time, it was like the forums were slowly dying. It was like, now we're getting sneaker YouTubers because it was the first part, like this was like the beginning of YouTube. And it was just interesting to see a brand like jump in and be like, yo, we got this, you know, we here. You know, and
you wanted to, I mean, as a brand, you want to be a part of a community that's unserved, right? Because then you can, but you got to be about it. It can't be transactional, right?
Right.
And so in my eyes, it was like, yo, if we're going to do this, let's go all the way and let's really be a part of it. Unfortunately, that's not what ended up happening after that. And I ended up leaving, but like that was a real thing. And like, it really would have taken off if, you know, the plan would have gone and the investment would have come from the corporate level. But that's one of those examples where, like, I always say Saucony taught me so much of what I know today from a marketing perspective, simply because they let me try things, simply because I got to experiment.
Yeah. It's funny. Cause like I've only missed one seminar you put on. And so it was the one that just happened recently.
You missed one.
I missed it. Yeah, I was like, I was so upset I missed that one. But one thing I feel like you stress leveraging your network and the idea of mentorship, where you just talk about mentorship is like, I've never had mentorship, but do you feel like mentorship can come in different styles
I didn't have mentorship until I got to Saucony in that regard, right? In the sneaker space, right? So sometimes you got to make up your own mentor. Sometimes you got to be mentored from afar. Sometimes if you see something that Joe Fresh does and you're like, that's actually dope, you know, borrow that. You know what I mean? That's mentorship, right? If you see something that James Whitner does and you're like, that's dope, I want to steal a piece of that, right? That's mentorship. Mentorship doesn't always be a conversation sometimes, right? Sometimes you need to be listening to the interviews to see what they're saying. That's mentorship. Alele may take time to do an interview. Go listen to it. Pull the insights. You know what I'm saying? Go listen to old Virgil interviews. Go listen if you appreciate the genius of creativity from Kanye West. Go listen to they leave it out there,
pick the right interviews on that one.
Maybe the ones before 2015.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, for me it's like stop making excuses for why we think like we aren't where we are. Interviews exist. That is a form of mentorship, right? Now, what you might want might be sponsorship. And sponsorship to me from a person is somebody taking an interest and putting me in play. That's different, right? Somebody might come up and it might be like Bima, like, I think you'd be really great for this. I'm gonna make you an introduction, and I'm gonna double down that they need to make sure you're there. They need to make sure you're at ComplexCon, like Mark Sperling did for me last year, right? That to me is personal sponsorship. That person saw me, has been seeing me put in work, and they think I'd be a great contribution to the show, right? So that's what I mean when I say that. It's like, it's gotta, we have to be, we can't let it be an excuse. Don't let anything be an excuse, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you want it, you gotta figure it out, because everybody else has come before you, they've had to figure it out too. Some have had more abilities and opportunities perhaps, but they still had to figure some stuff out.
No, yeah. I'm very curious of, like, where does your hustle mentality come from?
I would say the things that I want to do and the experience that I want to have in life, it requires me to do certain things. Mm-hmm. That's kind of it at the end of the day. And that at the biggest part is, I know what I'm here to do. I know that I'm here to teach other creatives how to what I call claim their creative freedom, right? Mm-hmm. So I know that that's what I'm here to do. That's who I'm here to serve. I'm here to help folks figure out how to get clients. If that means they want to do collabs, that's what I'm here to help folks figure out. Mm-hmm. And so I have that. I don't have it from a fear place. Like, I don't have the fear of, like, I'm not going to make it. I have it from an inspiring place. I move out of inspiration now and love, because I know that every time I actually share something, I know it's actually going to change the trajectory of a creative that once was where I was, mm-hmm. or I was once where they are now, right? And so that's why I get up and do what I do, man. I know it's bigger than me. And so how could I be so selfish to keep all that information to myself?
No.
And I had friends that told me that to my face. Mm-hmm. That's why we friends. It's because they were honest with me. They told me that, like, you've been doing these things. No one knows how to do them. You got to share this information. And it changed a lot for me.
Look, you helped me a lot in general. So thank you. But like, it's interesting because we live in a world where people, I mean, the term has been thrown around for years now, gatekeeping, and people gatekeep their success. But is it out of fear that somebody's going to move past the progress that initial person has pushed forward? Or is it fear out of they're losing their spot?
I mean, I think it could be a number of things, right? Like, you think about, think about it as far as, like, let's look at it like Nike versus Adidas, right?
Right.
There's a competitive reason why they would gatekeep. Mm-hmm. You know, Nike wouldn't want to share all the things that they're working on because they wouldn't want Adidas to then take those things and then best them. So it's some of it can come from a place of being competitive. Another part can come from a place of scarcity. Some folks believe that there are only a few opportunities in the marketplace, and that if they give up too much information, then they can't, you know, maintain in a spot. And then some folks just don't believe that they need to do it. Some folks just selfish. Sorry. End of the day, some folks just selfish, right? But personally, you know, one of my mentors and folks that I look up to is James Whitner. And James don't gatekeep. You know, that's what Free Game exists for. That's why he created it in the first place, is to share the information. Because when you're solid about what you're building, right, like, you're not in a place where you feel like somebody's going to come take that from you, right? It's yours. You're doing this for the community. Nobody's coming to take it. It's like, right? I'm giving information so somebody can figure out the next thing, right? Mm-hmm. What's authentically meant for them, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm always comfortable giving away the information I give. Like, my win is when you come and tell me, like, you know, Beam, I just landed this sponsorship. Bet. Go ham. You know what I'm saying? Like, it means nothing for me to be the only one at the table.
No, yeah. The especially in sneakers, I feel like niche industries, it's like built on gatekeeping. And it's like ingrained in this where it's like when you get to that point, you got into the club, the bouncer let you in, and you looking at everybody else on the outside like, aha, I'm in here. And, you know, like, I feel like that's, like, especially with sneakers, I feel like that's such a thing that just like is spread throughout. But like, have you seen an instance where somebody did that for you, especially within sneakers?
Where someone like gave me an opportunity, or where someone like
minus outside of the Complex Con hosting gig.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think somebody that doesn't get enough flowers, especially as an ally, is Brendan Dunn. You know, Brendan and I met like 2013 at like some Foot Locker ball, or maybe like 2014. But, you know, we were very early in our careers. I was early at Saucony. He was early at Soul Collector. And we've just, you know, been, you know, colleagues and become friends over that time. And when I was doing my the first season of the Claim a Stories podcast, Brendan was one of the first people that reached out and said, we'll do a story. And I'm gonna connect you with a writer on Soul Collector, and we're gonna do a story about the podcast, right? And so that's the other thing why relationships are important, right? But that didn't come because, you know, it was transactional. It came because we have a relationship. Brendan is invested. It made sense. It wasn't a handout, and he had, you know, seen me put the work in. And so that was one of those instances, right, where it was just like, wow, like somebody like really showed love. Now, the other thing too, that the other reason why I don't have a problem giving out information is because I know how hard it is to take action. Right. And so if I give you the information, now I know it's on you. What you going to do with it? Are you going to wake up on the days you don't want to wake up? Are you going to do the things that are hard? Are you going to be disciplined? Right. Because I could give you a whole playbook, and there's so many people that still won't do anything. So to me, it's like, it's whatever to me. I'll give you everything.
As they say, you can teach a man to fish. No, wait, what's the story? What's the phrase? You can bring a man to water, but you can't teach him how to fish, or something like that. I don't know. I said it wrong in my head. And now I can't get it out.
That's funny.
Oh, man. Bima, so at the end of the podcast, hopefully you remember the story that you told me at ComplexCon. So this is Jordan 9. I think, right? It was the Jordan. All right. People gonna listen to this and be like, these guys don't even know. But
there'd be so many stories, man. It'd be hard to remember sometimes.
I know, yeah. watch me look at the video and be like, it's not even a Jordan 9. But I want you to think about that moment where you're about to open that box with the Jordan 9 in it. And now you're you, older you, behind younger you. What would you tell younger Bima before they open that box?
Man, you just don't know what type of ride this about to send you on. And I would also say, it's okay to have something that you're passionate about, even if other people don't understand it yet. It's totally okay for that to just be your little piece of joy. And one day it might unlock something super special, but for now, at that moment in time, this might just be your niche, but like, boy, oh boy, you have no idea what ride this is about to send you on.
You're about to make your own van, bro. Like,
this is going to be your ticket to do great things in the world, to actually help other people. And by helping other people, you get to do some unlock some fantastic things in your own life. And so, I still shout out to my mom and my cousin for the inspiration, my mom for getting the sneaker. And that's when they had a little red button on the back of the nines that didn't even have any details in it because I had the kid size kicks.
They just put it like basically
it's literally a red button.
It's the top of a Coca-Cola bottle. You're just like, here you go.
It's literally a red button. And then I look at my cousins and they got, you know, it's got a whole graphic design. Yeah. And I'm like, where is mine? So, but yeah, man, I'm so happy that sneakers have been a part of my life in that way, and that I've been able to figure out how to make it a career, and that I've been able to figure out how to help other people.
Yeah. Yo, like I said, you've helped me so much, and hopefully you continue to help me as we maybe have become friends. But thank you for so much for jumping on. And for everybody out there, you know, we say each week, wear your kicks. Peace.